This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, August 16th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for Ozarks at Large comes from Custom Awards and Engraving in Fort Smith, offering awards and recognition products to the River Valley in Northwest Arkansas for 26 years. Products and more information available at mycustomawards.com.
Later on this edition of Ozarks, two prominent Arkansas political bloggers talk to Roby Brock from TalkBusiness.net about a recent party affiliation switch in the State House. Ryan Spearman gives us a preview of his performance at this month's Fayetteville Roots Festival, and Artemis takes a new direction.
But first, record heat and drought this summer have stressed both urban and rural forests. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich assesses the damage.
It's only mid-August, but it looks like late September in the Ozarks. Trees are turning, leaves are falling, and instead of mowing, many of us did this over the weekend. Leaf cleanup. That's because one reaction by trees to extended drought and heat is shedding leaves to preserve precious water and energy. Kevin Hickey, forester with the Arkansas Forestry Commission, Washington County office, provides forestry advice to landholders in both Washington and Madison counties.
With the timber in the area is that they are responding to the stress caused by the heat and the drought. In some cases, the trees are going into dormancy early.
Hickey says our midsummer autumn display is due to chlorophyll being pulled back into the leaf system, allowing the yellows and oranges to show through. Pretty, but disturbing. Hickey says location also matters.
Those trees that are on lower sides of the hill probably have access to more soil moisture and should weather the drought quite well. Trees that are located on the thin soils of a dry ridgetop, for example, may be put under much greater stress and may not be able to cope. And then, too, there is the situation of microsites. A tree may have become established and has been surviving for many, many years, but really hasn't been thriving, doing as well as it could have. And all it takes is for some sort of, natural situation such as the ice storm 2 years ago or this year's drought to kind of nudge the tree over the edge. And from that, it just won't survive.
Cedars and shortleaf pine, common on the Ozark Highlands, tend to survive harsh conditions, so should be okay.
Conifers seem to be able to withstand poorer sites, poorer soils, and therefore be able to survive better through situations such as a drought. The hardwoods tend to need more moisture, tend to need a richer soil in order to, again, survive and thrive.
And elder trees are likely at risk.
Trees, like people, as they age, become more susceptible to outside influences and stress and may find themselves put at a higher risk because of something such as the drought or flooding. And so a lot depends on just how much the age difference we're talking about. Some of these oaks, for example, can live 200-300 years, but that's only if the conditions are good. Other species, such as black oak, for example, only typically live 100 to 150 years. And so if they're reaching that point, then they're more likely to succumb to the stress of a drought.
So-called tree mast, wild fruit and nut crops are also being affected.
One thing we've noticed is that this past week we were doing a timber inventory on 40 acres, and there was quite the variety of tree species on the site, but we were noticing that the white oak mast was dropping already. And a coworker was wondering if the nuts were any good, and so we picked some up, cut them open, and found that they were solid. They appeared to be good. But for some reason, the tree was dropping them sooner. Now, I have no idea if the seed was viable and would germinate, but as long as it looked healthy, it was solid, it should at least provide food source for the critters, out there in the forest. But it's a little soon for them.
It's too soon to tell, but if lots more trees drop seed early, that could lead to forage shortages for wildlife. So what should you do if your black oak shade tree in the front yard looks dead? Kevin Hickey recommends you wait it out, just in case.
The easiest thing to do would just be to wait and see if the tree leaves out in the spring. If the tree does not leaf out in the spring, then you know it's dead.
David Staley, distinguished professor of geosciences at the U of A, is director of the Tree Ring Lab. He's a dendrochronologist. He studies tree rings to determine age, as well as climate and fire history.
Well, here in Arkansas, we're living history in 2011. I mean, it's been an amazing year climatologically and meteorologically, beginning, of course, with the all-time deepest snowfall ever recorded in Fayetteville and the persistent cold wave in late winter, followed by the incredible outbreak of tornadoes in April, then the development and record rainfall, by the way, in March and April. We had, I think, 15 inches in March and like 12 inches in April at Drake Field. So it was a prodigious rain event in the early spring, and then that gave way, you know, to prolonged drought that has culminated in this all-time epic heat wave where we tied the all-time highest thermometer reading ever observed, well, since about 1890, in Fayetteville, Arkansas. So it's been a historic year.
The northern portion of Arkansas, of course, received plentiful rain last week, creating in the Ozarks an unusual patchwork of green tree canopy with large blotches of orange, reds, and browns.
On a daily basis, trees regulate their carbon balance by adjusting the stoma, the pores on the underside of their leaves, and that affects the rate of gas exchange and photosynthesis and so forth, and moisture loss, evaporative moisture loss. And in extreme conditions, they'll keep the stomata closed for an extended period of time, and finally even just abscess and shed the leaf altogether. And so this is kind of a drought response, a drought deciduous response, if you will, of the plant to drought, a deciduous response on the part of the plants to drought.
Staley says maple trees seem to be having a harder time of it this summer.
Yeah, the non-native trees, some of the non-native trees that aren't irrigated are suffering more than others, and some of the native trees as well. I mean, we are very, you know, fond of maples, sugar maples and so forth. You're kind of on the southwestern fringe of Acer saccharinum's distribution, and they really don't care for this hot, dry conditions. And so you see a lot of the sugar maples really suffering around town. And compare those with the post oaks, which do well in hot, dry, acidic, nutrient-poor conditions, and they seem to survive it better. And it's really related to kind of the ecological distribution of those two species, and using them as an example for the distributions of all species. Some plants can tolerate moisture stress more than others.
But how will this record heat and drought play out long-term on Arkansas forests?
Yeah, so what we're seeing with this incredible heat wave and dry conditions in the summer may not, I expect most of the plants will survive this, most of the native trees will survive this, but some won't, and some will die right away, but probably the bulk of the mortality will not be expressed for 2 or 3 or 4 years. These kinds of intense heat waves and drought stresses can initiate a death spiral in the native trees that may play out, you know, over the next 5 years. And so we'll, I expect, see continued mortality in the wake of this event for a few years yet.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
There was a shift in Arkansas politics last week. Just how big a shift depends on who's handling the analysis. State Representative Linda Collins-Smith from Pocahontas switched parties, leaving Arkansas Democrats for the state's GOP. The first-term legislator says the Democratic Party has left her. Meanwhile, the chair of the Arkansas Democratic Party, Will Bond, responded by saying that the legislator didn't announce her switch until after new legislative district lines were drawn, and that Linda Collins-Smith was disappointed with her new legislative district boundaries. Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net discussed the ramifications of the switch with two Arkansas political observers, Jason Tolbert of the Tolbert Report and Michael Cook from Cook's Outlook. We'll hear from Jason Tolbert first.
Well, it's a big deal in one sense. From a historical perspective, it's never happened before. A Democrat in the state legislature has never switched to the Republican Party. There's never been one major party switch like this before. We've seen some minor deals where a Green Party legislature will switch back to the Democratic Party or something like that, but never a major party switch one to the other. So from a historic perspective, it's huge. From a realistic perspective, it really doesn't change much. The legislature went from 45 Republicans to 46 Republicans, so they didn't retake a majority or anything along those lines. But just in a symbolic sense, it does indicate that perhaps conservative Democrats are not feeling welcome in their own party.
Linda Collins-Smith was always a Republican. You know, back in 2004, she gave $1,000 to George W. Bush. Back in 2008, she gave $2,300 to Republican Mike Huckabee. Linda Collins-Smith is that classic example of a DINO, what we call a Democrat in name only. The only reason she ran as a Democrat in the first place because it was the only reason she felt that she could win. So she was always a Republican. Frankly, she just went home to the Republican Party. And the reason she did that is because redistricting put her in another district with a fellow Republican. And so this is more about sour grapes than any kind of true conservative principles.
That's our political bloggers Jason Tolbert and Michael Cook. Now, Republican officials claim that they've been in talks with more Democrats about switching parties, but declined to provide more details. We may hear more on this in the future. I also asked Tolbert and Cook for their thoughts on who had a good week in politics last week and who had a bad week. Michael Cook is up first.
My winner this week would be President Barack Obama, which is sort of counterintuitive with the markets fluctuating in this past week. I call him the winner this week because the Republican Party, at least their nominating process, is complete disarray. You know, Rick Perry is going to announce on Saturday. They have their straw poll, which means some of their lesser candidates are probably going to win that poll. So usually the Republican primary is pretty cut and dry on who wins, but right now it's a complete mess. Frankly, it almost looks like a Democratic primary. It's so convoluted.
Well, my winner this week are those in Arkansas that oppose the early implementation of the federal health care bill, of Obamacare. We saw a little news item come out this morning that said Arkansas is one of the states that has turned back some of these grants that would help pay for early implementation of the federal health care exchanges here in the state. Kansas and Oklahoma were two of the other states that turned that money back as well. And you really can thank some of the Republican state legislatures, particularly in the House, and some of the conservative legislatures, such as Linda Collins-Smith, that opposed that during the previous legislative sessions and kept the legislation that would have enabled us to accept that money from going into place. And so those in Arkansas who are opposing the early implementation of Obamacare, the federal health care bill, really won this week by not having that take place in the form of accepting those grants.
Loser this week is Linda Collins-Smith. The reason for that is because her switch from the Democratic to Republican Party this week exposed her as an opportunistic politician, which frankly is what she is. And she looked a little bit silly when it came out that she gave money to Republican candidates in the past and that the only reason why she switched parties was because she was not happy with how her district lines were drawn. So I think the loser this week really is Linda Collins-Smith.
My loser this week is the Arkansas State Lottery. We found out today that they've been assessed almost a $100,000 fine from the IRS for penalties and interest. That's a huge amount. I think that's, 25 or so scholarships that could have gone to students that aren't going to go to students now because of that fine. You know, we spent a lot of money on salaries for Ernie Passaway and some of his friends he brought in for South Carolina, really based on the premise that they knew how to run a state lottery, and we were going to spend a little bit of extra money to get the very best professionals. That hasn't turned out to be the case. They've had misstep after misstep. This one is just another of the continual missteps they've had, but this one comes with a $100,000 prize tag, which is just really huge. So I think the lottery again, is just the loser of the week because they have continued to mismanage their department. And I think that setback is just going to be another strike against Director Passaway.
Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net reviewed the past week's Arkansas political news with political observers and bloggers Jason Tolbert of the Tolbert Report and Michael Cook from Cook's Outlook. Support for content from TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com. And Verizon, offering small business solutions, including high-speed mobile broadband, wireless email, global services, and push-to-talk. More information at a Verizon communication store or online at vzw.com/smallbusiness.
This is Ozarks at Large. Later this month, the Fayetteville Roots Festival will host dozens of local and national music acts, bluegrass, folk, Americana, and old-time music, and several venues will be involved. Among the visiting musicians will be Ryan Spearman. He'll be traveling south from the St. Louis area, and he brings with him a repertoire that includes guitar, banjo, fiddle, and music made from recycled instruments. He writes, he sings, and he teaches. He's taught classes at the highly regarded Folk School of St. Louis. And he just released his latest CD. It's a compact disc that celebrates sustainability and features only instruments made locally or formed from recycled materials.
I'm so tired of all this trouble. Too much snow. Never rain, even miss poison ivy. Won't you take me back again?
Ryan Spearman, welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
Hey, this latest CD, the one with sustainability very much in the forefront, developed out of the Green Strum Project. What is the Green Strum Project?
In a lot of ways, the project developed out of the recording. As you mentioned, I'm an instructor. I teach at the Folk School, and I was teaching a class on jug band class, which is mixes conventional, traditional stringed instruments with household items like jugs and washboards and washtub bases, stuff you may be familiar with. And the more we did that class, the more I realized how much fun everybody was having and how it was bringing all these different elements together and different people of different skill levels together. So we were having a really positive outcome. And so at the same time, my wife and collaborator, Kelly Wells, we had been speaking for a while on how to incorporate into my music career something that went beyond simply performance and instruction, and maybe something that was a little more edifying or a little more socially viable. So we'd been looking for some way to marry my music with a bit of a cause. And the jug band class inspired me to say, hey, why don't we make an album out of all homemade instruments? I think I could do that. And then that turned into, hey, why don't we make it sustainably as possible? Let's keep it local. Let's make them all out of recycled materials. And so that grew into the album idea. And from there, we didn't really want to stop the momentum. So the idea just grew into something that we could turn into an organization. So that's what we're growing now. And we're giving demonstrations. I'm teaching people how to build some simple instruments out of recycled materials. Simple but very playable instruments. We've gone into classrooms and we've done demonstrations at festivals, and we're branching. We got 10 volunteers now, and we're branching into a lot of different musical fields.
There are some interesting sounding instruments on here. A cigar box banjo?
Yeah, what I've got on there is a cigar box ukulele, for one, and that's the first one I attempted to build. It turned out okay. I built that from a cigar box and then a little chunk of wood I had and some jewelry wire, an eye bolt, and a couple of little tuners. The cigar box ukulele is featured pretty prominently on there. There's one track that I play in a traditional banjo style, but it's actually on that ukulele.
I wish that I was way out west, some Rocky Mountain town. I'd find myself an old pine bed and lay my body down. I would lay my body down. Promised land, I'm bound away.
You also, I guess, are something of a baseball fan. You have a song dedicated to Willie McGee. Well, not just dedicated, but titled Willie McGee on this album.
Yeah, I sure do. If you'd like, I can explain.
Please.
that song. Well, as you mentioned, I live in St. Louis, and I actually grew up right outside of St. Louis. And although I spent about 10, 11 years away from home, I did return recently and have a lot of pride for the city. And it's a big baseball town here, and we have our heroes, our own personal folk heroes, and that's pretty undisputably Willie McGee would be one of those. As a child, that's some of my first, very impressionable memories. Some of my imprints from childhood would be the 1982 World Series. So when I got into the project of doing this local sustainable recording, I decided, well, I should try to theme some of the music anyhow. I should make it pretty personal and try to theme a lot of it to St. Louis. So I had this song that I'd written by request. Somebody had requested that I write a song about Willie McGee, a friend of mine had. So I had written it and played it a couple of times and then kind of put it on the shelf. But when this album came out, I decided it'd be a good time to revive it. I actually based the song, I had to do a little research to get to know Willie a little more than I did at the time. And I found out that his full name was Willie Dean McGee. And so that's in the song, obviously. And so what I decided to do ultimately was to base the song on a traditional love song. It goes back to, I think, the early 1800s. There's a song called Daisy Dean. And it's about, basically just about the love of Daisy Dean, but she's gone now. So what I did was adapt that, used most of the melody and adapted some of the words and wrote the story of Willie Dean McGee. So it's a love story of Willie Dean McGee and about how much we love him and what great things he did and how he's, in a sense, gone now. He's still with us on Earth, but he has retired and left the game a little less desirable.
It was down in St. Louis, Clark Street and Broadway, where the springtime grass is ever fresh and green. Bruce Sutter in the bullpen, Fred Bird was dancing when I first saw Willie Dean McGee. He was born in November, he heard Cincinnati in a finer game there never has been seen. And his 82 game three was such a sight to see. I love me some Willie Dean McGee.
What kind of archaeology do you perform when you're looking for songs that you might play or adapt?
That's a good question. It should be noted that at this point in my career, I tend to have about a 50-50 stack of, in my performances, of traditional music, older and traditional Americana type of music, folk music, and then my own original stuff. My original stuff inevitably draws from a lot of the older and traditional stuff. So even on my original songs, without any intentional archaeological maneuvers, I tend to accidentally or just for fun sneak in a lot of these old folk themes. I've been involved and interested in folk music for about 16, 17 years. On songs like Willie McGee, when I decide ahead of time, well, I don't just wait for the muse to tap me on the shoulder, I decide ahead of time, I'm going to write a song about this. In that case, I always do a little bit of research. But honestly, I always start first with what I know or what I think I know. And then I usually go to some of my immediate friends and acquaintances and kind of run some questions and ideas by them, find out what they know or think they know. Then I usually turn to the World Wide Web to get a lot of information. And the final stroke is to hit the library. But honestly, usually any kind of periodical or book research that goes into any of my song usually happens the other way around. It's usually something I just happen to be interested in and kind of saturating myself with. I get into a certain idea. I'm just kind of following up on some information I'm interested in that might turn into a song.
There is a song on the CD, Get Along Home, that kind of touches on a theme that, gosh, has been written about by Stephen Foster to the Stanley Brothers to the Leuven Brothers all the way up to Bruce Springsteen. And that's the song Hometown, which is about going back to a hometown, and it's not quite the way the singer or narrator remembers it.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Hometown, that was another one that was written by suggestion. Somebody suggested. Her actual request was she had just returned from a visit to France and was stuck on the tarmac when she returned for a long time. And it was really humid, and it was just a disappointing reentry experience for her. And so the request was, write a song about that. And I took that and twisted around to my own liking and thought, I'll write a song about my hometown, because I grew up in St. Peter's, Missouri, which is now a suburb of St. Louis. It's a good 30-minute drive west across the Missouri River. It was a very much a country town growing up in the beginning, and then it quickly became kind of the epitome of urban sprawl, suburbia, strip mall, subdivision kind of living. And to me, I think that had a profound effect on me. I mean, I know it did, and I find that one of the themes that creeps up in a lot of my writing is hometown and kind of progress for the sake of progress, those ideas. So Hometown was really written about my hometown of St. Peter's and about the feel of heading back there after years and years.
This is not how I remember my old hometown. I get lost on once familiar roads. My smile's a broken frown. All the stoplights have grown eyes in the time I've been away. Watching every turn I make, waiting for my next mistake. Just like
Ryan Spearman will be among the musicians playing at this month's Fayetteville Roots Festival at Walton Arts Center. He'll be among the more than two dozen artists playing at the festival the weekend, the 27th and 28th. Headliners include Guy Clark. For more information about the festival, FayettevilleRoots.com. And for more information about Ryan Spearman, RyanSpearman.net.
It's Tuesday, August 16th, 2011. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellens.
And joining us now is Becca Bacon-Martin. She's the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
And from tractor pulls to Artemis.
Talked about tractor pulls a little bit yesterday.
And then after we got off the air, we explained to Antoinette what a tractor pull was.
Yeah, because I never really knew what that meant. I didn't know what they were pulling.
Mm-hmm. But this makes perfect sense if you happen to grow up in Kansas. Artemis makes perfect sense if you're growing up in Fayetteville.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This is an opportunity. You know, they were the first to do these big mixed media shows, music and fashion and visual arts and all sorts of things. They've kind of stopped doing that because the trend caught on. So now they're doing smaller shows, more focused on one kind of art. Tonight, it's visual arts. On the 25th, it's fashion. Tonight's visual art show, there will be about 35 works by 7 or 8 artists, paintings, mixed media, sculpture, photography, and it's all for sale. Artemis does get a commission, and that money goes to scholarships and other things to help artists. Artist grants, whether it's a screenplay or whatever. The visual art show is at 7 o'clock tonight at Teatro Scarpino in Fayetteville, and it's $5 to get in. The fashion show is at 6 o'clock on August 25th at the Matt Miller Studio in downtown Fayetteville, and it's $10 to get in, but that includes food. Mm. And you can find Artemis on Facebook. And tomorrow, something early in the day, so we want to be sure and get you now, there's a sandwich din program at noon at the Shiloh Museum with Al Einert, University of Arkansas Professor Emeritus of Horticulture, who will be talking about native plant lore.
Right.
And if you've never been to a Shiloh sandwich din, it's a great time, and they have cookies.
Yay, cookies.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers. And as Becca just mentioned moments ago, Art Amiss is sponsoring an event tonight. And with me now in the studio is Beau Counts, who is the president, czar et al. Of Art Amiss. Welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Becca mentioned that Art Amiss now has more events and each one more specified.
Yes. That's been kind of our mission statement for the past, I guess you could call this season. And we're going to move forward with this idea. We're running with the less is more concept. You know, we're going to kind of not necessarily oversaturate you at one time, but spread all of these things out over more of a season, like so we can really focus more on the art and really represent each artist on a more individual level instead of just this overwhelming, like, oh, there's 70 artists of all these different mediums being hit at once. We're going to do music this time, fashion this time, visuals this time. And I think by spreading it out, you're going to be getting a lot more art and having more things to do. And I think everybody will like it.
There's an event tonight.
There is an event tonight. There's events everywhere. Tonight is going to be our visual portion of you could say, Artemis 14, which music has already happened. It happened a while back when we did the CD release party at Smoke and Barrel. But this is the visuals. This is the hangable art, 2D, probably a little bit of 3D. And it's going to be at Scarpino's tonight, August 16th at 7 p.m. And it's $5 to get in, and there will be music, really interesting music this time around. We're having Lee Young and Chris Cooper, and they are a sitar and dumbbell player. They're a little duo, and trained by someone who was really impressive, that was straight out of the Middle East, that's here in kind of a refugee status. And Lee Young has been trained by this guy, and he's apparently the bee's knees and sitar playing. So we're really excited about that. And of course, that $5 cover, all of the proceeds, and not even proceeds, all of it goes directly back to supporting these artists that are really trying to get their feet off the ground.
And on the 25th, then, is fashion.
Yes, the Artemis 14 fashion arm. And it's going to be at Matt Miller Studio, which is up on the square next to Jam and Java. And we're really excited about that one because not only is it a big fashion event, but it's also going to be the debuting of Matt Miller's mural project. Mm. And Artemis, we wrote a grant for Matt Miller to do this mural project along with other local organizations. And he's going to be unveiling it at the show. So it's going to be really exciting to have that as a backdrop to our latest fashion event. So, and that one is August 25th at 6 p.m. and it's $10, except for this time, since it's a little bit more, you're going to get free food from Trailside Tea Room and as well as complimentary libations.
I see. Is this new approach part of the maturation of Artemis?
Yes. I think the last time I was up here, we kind of touched on this coming in the future. Mm-hmm. Now it's here. And as we grow, we can't really be contained in just one event every quarter. It's just going to have to mature. And with that, things, like I said, events are going to get a little bit smaller and more focused. So we've been really kind of hoping that the community will kind of grow with us and say, okay, this may not be the same as what I'm used to, but look at the ways that it's much better instead of just the ways that it's different. And in fact, look at the ways that it's different too, because we're always about making people look at things differently and looking at art differently and looking at their community differently. And this is just a new way for us to do it.
Since Artemis has begun, Fayetteville Underground and mm-hmm. First Thursdays have mm-hmm. developed, and other events have taken root. Has this been part of the Artemis conversation?
A little bit, and that was one of the reasons we decided to kind of start going in a new direction. Is we've been around for 7 years, mm-hmm. and one of the longest running art organizations in town when we started actually doing our homework, and that really surprised us. We're like, whoa, because it doesn't feel like we've been around for that long, but we got to thinking, well, there's so many people doing exactly what we started doing, which is awesome because it, as long as everybody feeds off of each other, we're building an art community. You can have plenty of chiefs because there's a lot of Indians here. And if all the chiefs work together, then, man, we're gonna do something great. But we started to evaluate, like, where the need was. And the need was on more artist-centric events, because there's a First Thursday Bentonville, there's a First Thursday Fayetteville, there's these big
Rogers has a gallery walk, Eureka Springs
yep.
has,
and then as soon as Crystal Bridges comes, mm-hmm. Which I'm really excited that they've reached out to Artemis to do some of their events once they get off the ground, and that'll be really cool, and I'll have more information on that later. But we decided these big events are happening, let's do something else.
So you see this as a rising tide.
Oh,
everyone's
yes.
coming up together.
Oh, yes.
Tonight, $5 mm-hmm. at Scarpino's. That's just off Dixon in Fayetteville.
Yep, just off Dixon.
25th at Matt Middle. And you mentioned coming up with a grant to help with the mural project. That's part of what Artemis does. I know you've helped people produce CDs and things like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. We sure do. I think with the last one we wrote was for the Memphis Pencils mm-hmm. to get their album off the ground. And now this one's for Matt Miller. And, we take applications for grants all year round. We can only award so many. But when we do, we're just really, really happy to be able to support local artists in doing something that they love and hoping that, you know, they can eventually become established artists. And in the case of Matt Miller, you know, he is a relatively new established artist, but he's also doing something that's specifically for the community, and it's something that'll be around, and we were just so happy to be involved with it.
Artemis.org?
That's right, and we're actually doing a website redesign, which is really exciting because that other website's been around since, you know, early 2000s and pre-social media, pre all that fun stuff. But it's going to probably be launching early next month. So look out for that. And, of course, we're on Facebook. That's where a lot of the newest information is right now while our website's being redesigned.
Bo, thank you very much.
Thank you much for having me.
The Fayetteville Roots Festival is a 2-day urban music festival that will be held on August 27th and 28th and will feature Ozark culture, music, and food. Local merchants will offer organic and fair trade items, locally designed and produced jewelry, plus live art, sculpture, and photography exhibits. Tickets and more information are available at FayettevilleRoots.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums. With me is Wayne Bell. He writes the column Culture Club, found at FayettevilleFlyer.com. Wayne, welcome back to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio.
Thank you.
Let's see. We're going to talk about romantic comedies this week. But first, I want to tell you that I saw something that wouldn't be called a romantic comedy, and that was Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, and did you enjoy it?
I give it a thumbs up. I'll put this caveat. If you have ever seen a Planet of the Apes movie before and liked it, you'll love this.
Even the Mark Wahlberg movie? Then you'll really like
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Then you'll... Yeah, the Tim Burton
I've heard that the... was it Andy
Serkis?
Serkis, you know, he's kind of the top of the craft for that field, from King Kong to Lord of the Rings. And so I've heard that that's really an amazing performance. I know when I saw the trailer come out, I thought, oh, this could be real good or it could be real bad. But reviews have been pretty positive. And over the weekend, other things that did really well, The Help did really well.
Which attracted a mature adult audience.
Yes, mostly a female, but mature adult. It came in at number 2 and did really, really well with reviews and with audience scores. And then, you know, some other things held on pretty well, like the Smurfs movie and some of those other, you know, films that have been around for a little bit. They held on pretty well. Surprisingly, though, I noticed didn't even crack the top 10 was the Glee 3D movie.
Right.
I don't know if that's oversaturation or if that was a case of people looking at it and saying, you know, we see this on a weekly basis. Why should we have to pay for it? Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know. It did okay. I mean, it certainly didn't cost anything to make it. So they just filmed a tour spot. So it did okay. But, you know, it was just kind of surprising. But yeah, Planet of the Apes, The Help, Smurfs, they all did fine.
Now, I know one of your favorite movies, if not your favorite movie so far of the summer season, has been the
Crazy Stupid Love.
Yes.
Yeah, and that was probably the best thing I've seen this year so far, saying I haven't seen The Help and I haven't seen Planet of the Apes, and those are the other movies that have got really good reviews this year. But it did get me start. It didn't make me start to appreciate that, you know, we don't have a ton of these adult movies, and that's probably part of the reason why The Help did well too. And then I was looking at Entertainment Weekly this past week, and there was a story in there about why romantic comedies are so difficult to make now. And it kind of laid out 6 tenets of why it's so difficult to make. And they started the story with talking to Woody Allen via email, and he said, you know, for the most part, any genre is difficult to make a good movie. But for some reason, that particular genre has been incredibly hard to make in the past, say, 10 years.
Well, and you're stuck with a formula that you have to kind of break away from, I think, because you don't want to go in and have the predictable couple meets, couple breaks up, couple gets back together, which seems to be the formula.
No Strings Attached or Friends with Benefits or anything with Katherine Heigl or Cameron Diaz or Jennifer Aniston, you know, that has come out in the past few years. It seems like or Kate Hudson. It's the same movie over and over and over and over again, and it beats it into the ground. And you look at the mid-90s, if you look back to the late 80s, early 90s, you had the Meg Ryan period, and then you had the big Julia Roberts summer period where that's what she was really doing. And, you know, they were predictable, but at the same time, they were somewhat smart and they were enjoyable. You look at like My Best Friend's Wedding or Notting Hill, those movies, you know, whether you love them or hate them, you can at least go, you know, they gave us something different. And she was a real likable person. And the Katherine Heigl and Kate Hudson, they're not Julia Roberts. They're not in the same league as Julia Roberts. You could tell that watching Eat, Pray, Love last summer. A lot of people didn't like it, but nobody questioned her,
right,
or her presence. And so there's not a lead there. There's not a marketable person that you just go, I really want to see them. And then so with Crazy Stupid Love, it's got, you know, a bunch of actors that you wouldn't necessarily associate with a romantic comedy. And that's probably why it works so well.
I have a theory, and this may make me sound old, but I think it's harder to make a romantic comedy now because Jack Lemmon isn't alive anymore.
Oh.
I mean, it just seems like when you go back and you look at the stars, I mean, you have Tom Hanks, but many of the stars or people who star in romantic comedies now.
Yeah, and that Tom Hanks, Julia Roberts movie didn't work.
No.
You know, it didn't get good buzz, so.
So you like Crazy Stupid Silly
Love.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, the thing that Entertainment Weekly laid out, they laid out some tenets as to why they don't work. And the first one was that chemistry can't be faked. Mm-hmm. And you look at movies where you have the leads, and you just start to see, especially like the Kate Hudson, Matthew McConaughey, Catherine Heigl, Josh Duhamel, Ashton Kutcher, Natalie Portman. You just kind of go, I don't quite get it.
It's not Tracy Hepburn.
No, it's not. It's not even, you know, Gere and Roberts or Ryan and Hanks. It seems contrived. And so that's kind of the first big complaint. The second complaint they had was that men don't want to star in them. And
what about Hugh Grant?
About him? I mean, he did a long, he did a period, but he's kind of hidden now. Mm-hmm. We don't see a lot of Hugh Grant. We did have with Bridget Jones' Diary, you know, you look at Hugh Grant and Colin Firth, and, you know, they had really good supporting performances, but it was a female lead. And, you know, to see a romantic comedy made that has a co-billed lead, a male, it just doesn't happen that much. There's that Nancy Meyers, Something's Gotta Give, with Jack Nicholson and Diane Keaton. That's a good movie, but it wasn't a summer, you know, romantic comedy. It came out in the winter.
So what happened? I mean, because Bogart would make romantic comedies. He was in Sabrina. I mean,
I don't know. And then part of it is the money. Typically, the budget's not there to lure a huge, you know, George Clooney or something like that, like an action film can. Entertainment Weekly also had stated that romantic comedies are so America-centered that they don't do well internationally. The way a Planet of the Apes or something like that can come across and do, you know, a huge number internationally, or Harry Potter.
Right.
If you have an American story, like Friends with Benefits.
Justin Timberlake and...
Mila Kunis.
Right.
You know, that's a very, you know, can we have a just, you know, a sexual relationship with no feelings or emotions? That doesn't play well in a lot of parts of the world. So, you know, that's a big reason why they're not made. The other things they said are that filmmakers are very much afraid to get too personal, and that filmmakers tend to dumb things down. I do think in the past few years there have been a couple that I actually quite liked. But the rule of thumb seems to be that in order for a romantic comedy to get made or to be successful, they have to be together. The couple has to end the movie together. I was thinking back to this movie I saw not too long ago. Again, but I saw it maybe 5-6 years ago when it came out. It was called Prime. Mm-hmm. And it was Meryl Streep and Uma Thurman. Got really no press, but it's been out for 6 years, so the jig is up. They don't end up together in the movie, the main couple. And people left really angry. They didn't want to see that. And or the Jennifer Aniston Vince Vaughn movie, The Breakup. People said, oh, this is not what I was expecting. And it's like, you know, you can have a romantic comedy where the leads don't get together.
500 Days of Summer.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a great movie with great performances.
Movie. But, you know, it's just a small movie. So it was Once, the musical movie, which was great. But,
oh,
I mean,
that's a
fantastic movie if anybody hasn't seen it. But it's a small movie. And to make a big movie with big leads right now, you know, there's six from Entertainment Weekly plus another 8 that we probably come up with during this session of reasons why they just can't be made. It's a shame.
Wayne Bell writes the column Culture Club for FayettevilleFlyer.com. Wayne, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 16th of August, 2011. It's the birthday of Catherine Coburn, born London, 1670. She was the daughter of a sea captain who died of the plague when she was 4. Family struggled to get by. She was precocious, taught herself to read and write at an early age, came out with her first novel at the age of 14, entitled Adventures of a Young Lady, published anonymously, wrote her first play when she was just 16, wrote her first philosophical essay, The Defense of Mr. Locke's Essay of Human Understanding, and John Locke was so impressed that he sent her money. It's the birthday of the children's fantasy author Diana Wynne Jones, London, 1934. Dyslexic, but did well in school, started making up stories for her sisters when she was a child. Best known for her series, The Chronicles of Crestomancy, and Howell's Moving Castle in the mid-80s. It's the birthday of Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence, Thomas Edward Lawrence, born in Traumatic, Wales in 1888. His book, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, was an account of his exploits as a military advisor to Arabs in their revolt against the Turks. It was the basis for the film Lawrence of Arabia. It's the birthday of William Maxwell, the novelist, the editor, born Lincoln, Illinois, 1908, wrote about small-town, middle-American life in the early 20th century, editor at the New Yorker magazine, where he edited John Cheever, J.D. Salinger, Vladimir Nabokov, and John Updike. It's the birthday of Charles Bukowski, 1920, born in Andernach, Germany, to an American soldier, German mother, grew up in Los Angeles, abusive, alcoholic father, odd kid. He had a hard life. But at age 35, he started writing seriously, published his first book of poetry, Flower Fist and Bestial Whale, and published more than 45 books of prose and poetry in his lifetime. Left his job at the post office when Black Sparrow Press offered him $100 a week just to sit and write. Here's a poem for today by Linda Paston, The Ordinary Weather of Summer. In the ordinary weather of summer, with storms rumbling from west to east like so many freight trains hauling their cargo of heat and rain, the dogs sprawl on the back steps panting, insects assemble at every window, and we quarrel again, bombarding each other with small grievances, our tempers flashing on and off in bursts of heat lightning. In the cooler air of morning, we drink our coffee amicably enough and walk down to the sea, which seems to tremble with meaning and into which we plunge again and again. The days continue hot. At dusk, the shadows are as blue as the lips of the children stained with berries or with the chill of too much swimming. So we move another summer closer to our last summer together, a time as real and implacable as the sea, out of which we come walking on wobbly legs, as if for the first time, drying ourselves with rough towels, shaking the water out of our blinded eyes. The Ordinary Weather of Summer by Linda Paston, from Carnival Evening, New and Selected Poems, 1968 to 1998. Published by W.W. Norton & Company. Used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac. Produced by our technical director, Thomas Scheutzger. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The 13th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Series will conclude with vibraphonist Warren Wolf with the Claudia Berson Trio at Walton Arts Center Star Theater on Friday, August 26th at 8 p.m. Wolf is accomplished on vibraphone, marimba, drum set, percussion, and the piano, and has performed with Wynton Marsalis and the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra, Bobby Watson, and others. Tickets, including limited cabaret seating, are available at 443-5600 or waltonartscenter.org.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, No-Go.
And where is No-Go?
It's in Pope County. It's southeast of Raspberry.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
Tomorrow, most, if not all, of our show will be taking place from Jasper.
Mm-hmm.
Took a trip there last week, so we've got some Newton County stories.
We do.
That's tomorrow at noon on Ozarks at Large. I had a great trivia question today, but we didn't have time.
Well, we'll get it in this week.
Okay. So a brand new edition of Ozarks tomorrow at noon.
Yes.
Antoinette, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Have a good day, guys.